when I originally started being an artist, I didn't really want to apply to an MFA program. You know the whole story. Like, I just didn't think it was something I needed to do art, and it's true. But I've come to a point to where, like, I have big ideas that need big money and that needs like big institutions.
You feel me?
Yeah. And I think I've been holding myself back by like a lack of trust in like a system that like really doesn't and hasn't inspired my trust. But, you know, thanks to you and like a lot of love, like I just went ahead and applied. And I mean, it's been the most nerve-wracking waiting period, but I am so happy that I've gotten to the interview stage. And when I got the notice, I mean, you know, I'm a very like quiet celebrator. I was just like, hey mom, look at this. And then she was just like, oh my God. And then she gave me a mock interview, which was also nerve-wracking because she was like, no, you need to say it's more succinct. You talk too long, you know, stuff like that. But she was just like really supportive, which I'm really happy about. So yeah, like that is the big thing, the big news.
And that's amazing. I'm just trying to get it together over here. Okay, this is better. It was like really high and strange. Okay.
Yes.
So how are you going to reward yourself? Like, what's the plan?
Really, I started taking my life a lot slower. Like, I don't have this thing where, I used to be, like, really nervous if I didn't respond to emails in a 24-hour period. And so I've just been taking all things a lot slower. Even with the acceptance letter that I received, I was just like, I looked at it and then I exited out of it. And then I just watched TV and then came back to it. You know, it was like one of those things where I just kind of took my response to things a lot slower. And I think that's what I'm doing to reward myself just in 2022, is to like not be so overly emotional about things and take a lot more time, because that's just what I need. Like, that's just what my life needs. So yeah, and then other than that, you know, trying new hairstyles and loving on myself, you know.
That's amazing. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you.
Like, you deserve this. You deserve this.
I mean, I've been applying to another program called the it's called the AFRI Scholars. It's a fellowship between South Africa and the United States, and it's hosted by the.
Tell me about this one.
Yeah, the application is actually due today, and again, along the idea of like just taking my time, like I've actually been working on this application for a month, and an anxious version of myself would have submitted it like days ago.
Right.
But for me, I'm just like, they gave me until 2 p.m. I'm going to take until 1 p.m., you know?
So just any time. Yes.
Yeah. But in the scholarship, well, not the scholarship, but in the fellowship, they like want you to really reflect on who you are and who you are as a leader. And like some of the things that I was writing, I actually was thinking about it. And I wanted to talk about that with you today, because like one of the things they were saying was like, reflect on your experiences and tell us about a time that you changed. And one of the biggest things about my work here in Houston has been like, there's a lot of people doing the same kind of work. There's a lot of Afrocentric scholars working in an art space, trying to like decolonize that space for like health and wellness of the community. And like, however they would go about saying it, that's essentially what we're all doing. But in the past, like everyone's been so competitive, like nobody really wanted to work together. Yeah. And it's just led to like a lot of animosity, which is another layer of this like mistrust. It's just like, why apply to these art spaces when all I get is all this like hatred being thrown at me, like all this vitriol for no reason, which led me to like work in a silo, to be more isolated than I should have been, to be more distrustful. And one of the things that I've learned just from my like interaction and work with you and with others is that like it's that layer of protection is like unnecessary. Like I don't need to be so protective of myself. And you know, I could just, even if I don't get the love that I want back, just like share and share freely, share often, share loudly, you know.
Real loud.
Yes. Because I mean, it's necessary, even for those people who are demonstrating the unwelcome behavior, like they probably have felt the same things that I'm feeling. That's why they're exhibiting that towards me. Yeah. And that's love. That's like learning to love your community in a way that, I don't know, it takes practice, you know? And so many times I've been like, I hate this place. Like,
yes, but... yes. Who would have bought here?
I mean, when that happens, I guess what I do is I do retreat until I can find some love for it and come back to it. Cause I don't want to be spreading all that. I don't want to be like, I hate this place and I hate you and I hate this work and I hate all this. You know, I just be like, you know what? I'm going to be gone.
Oh, bye. Hello. Bye. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So, I mean, like, I think everything we're starting off with is really like the themes. I spent this whole month like engaging in Black love and understanding Black love in like all the ways that it can be presented. One of the recaps that I have when I was just like thinking about like, what have I learned so far? So like the first recap is that love is actually metaphysical. Like our emotions are connected to like this metaphysical space that we don't recognize and or like it's not always apparent to us, but like because we are part of like this cosmos and this cosmic life, like the only thing that really connects us to like this place where your thoughts exist the place between where your thoughts exist and where your physical reality exists are our emotions. Our emotions allow us to understand like warning signs, like it allows us to understand our intuitions. And by engaging those emotions and taking them seriously and not like turning down the volume of on them, we are being our full cosmic selves. And love is a big, big part of that. And so that's one thing about love that was something, it really hadn't been discussed to me in a very like simple and plain way. Mm-hmm. Like every time someone talked about metaphysics, it was somehow like Disney magic or the Matrix, you know? But the metaphysics is actually something so simple because we are part of the metaphysical world, and like who we are and how we feel is like actually channeling that. Mm-hmm. So that's one takeaway. And then another takeaway came from watching Waiting to Exhale. Mm-hmm. And so in that story, we thought about all the different love stories in there. And the story starts off during the new year, and all these women are like going through changes, and like these changes are difficult. There's like a lot of emotions and anger, but again, like these emotions that they're feeling allows them to transform. And so like some of the themes that are in Waiting to Excel, you could probably guess there's like a lot of self-love. There's like a lot of understanding what you want internally and then manifesting that, you know. There's a lot of just like making sure that your romantic relationships don't diminish who you are and you don't allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. And you know, like all these different like storylines were just I think the most impactful, like Waiting to Exhale, as I discussed in the previous podcast, was one of those like seminal Black movies. Like the only movie that I could really think that could even match the magic of that was When We Went to Wakanda, you know, because yeah. Waiting to Exhale had like a star cast. And so this is like a piece of art that a previous generation made for the next generation to really let them know, like, what does it mean to love yourself as a Black person? And what does it mean to love others in your community as a Black woman? And how do you grow through that? And I just really appreciated Terry McMillan for creating that piece of art to help guide us as we like go into this topic again, like over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And then the last question I had on this topic was like, recently, like especially with the conversation between bell hooks and Audre Lorde and all these Black feminist writers, is this idea of like Black love saving us all. You know, like the world around us is changing. You know, it's the old systems are not sustainable, and so the only sustainable thing that really makes any sense is like building communities of love. Because if you build the communities of love, then you're always going to be able to produce from a healthy space. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're at now in like this thinking. Like, I was skeptical about Black love saving us all at first. Because I've had lots of experiences in Black love, mm-hmm. and lots of experiences as a Black woman in love. And I just kind of felt like, don't nobody love me, but that's not always true. And I guess I want to open up right there on like, what do you think about that phrase? Like Black love will save us all.
I think it's very much so true. I also think in that phrase, some people will be left behind, right? Like, if you don't understand the concept, and if you're not willing to participate in the concept, you get left, and that's love too. And I think that's also important because Black love does have accountability in it. And so when I think about Waiting to Exhale, I think accountability is one of the themes, like accountability for yourself, and then doing as much as you can to hold other people accountable, even though we know at the end of the day, the only person who can hold you accountable is yourself. But what we can do is at least get people to a place where they recognize, okay, maybe I need to hold myself accountable. So I think that's true. I feel like the other part of it is, if I think about Black love diasporically, it also means that you're oriented or trained to see similarities before you see differences. Mm-hmm. Right? So if I'm going somewhere, if I'm meeting a Black person, right, I'm a Southern Black woman, straight, mother, if I meet somebody on the West Coast, you know, a Black person who has different identities from me, In order to manifest Black love, I have to say, oh, okay, tell me about your story, right? And I listen and I say, oh, okay, well, I can identify with some of the things that you just shared, right? And so I think that's part of it too, is being able to go to different places and spaces and be able to identify where we are similar first versus where we are different.
Okay, I agree with that. And again, returning to these applications that I've been doing, the thing I always lead with when I'm talking about my work, because my work is mostly how do we create spaces where we can collectively dream? How can we create spaces where everyone is actually doing something? Because like education is largely a thinking experiment in America. The expectation is never that you actually get up and go implement any of these things. We're just here to think about it, which is a very useless thing in today's time. I was just imagining, like, what if every high school student had to do an environmental cleanup project? Like, all the kids we have here, like, we would have so many ideas on how to create sustainability in the environment if that was the expectation, that you're actually getting up and going to do something. But the way that we frame our education, or at least the way our education has been framed, isn't really from a place of love. It's from a place of, like, control, to make sure that only a few people get these opportunities to engage in creative acts. Only a few people have the actual mental health to think in innovative ways. Mm-hmm. And so, like, whenever I'm thinking about, like, my actual work, I always say, like, first thing we need to do is, in order to create sustainable change, is to focus on our mental health and creating spaces where we have collective community care. Because if we're focusing on that first, and racial justice and racial equity would be an attainable goal. Because another phrase that I like that you said a long time ago is that we can't have, what is it? We can't have a revolution without our bodies.
Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm. And whenever I think about my own role as a Black mother, I think the biggest fear I always have is that my child is going to receive the same lack of love that I received. Mm-hmm. 'Cause, you know, she's as smart and as loving and as funny and as, you know, mischievous as I am. And that was always read as, you know, I'm being, well, for my great grandmother, who I knew from Alabama, I'm being smart with her, you know?
Yes. Which is, oh, like, yes.
Or, you know, for my dad, it was like, I'm not respectful because I have so many questions. And for anyone else, it's like, I'm not pulling my own weight because I don't want to be put into a situation of, like, mental unwellness because of the work that is being required or expected. And, you know, Black love includes, like community love, love for our kids. And I was reading somewhere on the Instagrams where someone was just like, we tend to put on a pedestal this, like, romantic one-on-one love between individuals, but we don't understand, like, the real love comes from, like, community. And I was really reflecting on that because, again, when I'm talking about my business and these grants and stuff like that, like, any real change really does require a collective. Like, you can't do nothing by yourself, and anything that you create that's only based on your own experiences is ultimately not going to be revolutionary, because everyone here needs this. Everyone here is in need of a solution. So the solution has to be designed with everyone in mind. Mm-hmm. And I get so emotional when I think of, like, you know, like, they always do these math problems. Like, if one person, if everyone in the world just recycled, like, if one person just recycled one bottle every day, there'd be a billion bottles recycled, you know? Mm-hmm, and that's, like, math that's really talking about, like, how we as a collective have the ability to transform the world if we all just adopted a certain mindset. And, I didn't get a chance to do this, but, like, I know that you work in ways that amplify community work. And I want you to, I know we're in the middle of this, but can you tell me about yourself? And how does your work really amplify community and the collective?
Oh, these are always so, questions so hard. Okay, so I'll start with just what some of my identities are. So I am a Black woman, right? African-American, Black, born in the South, born in Texas. I'm a mother. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a millennial. I am Oh my gosh. I'm in a sorority. I am an introvert. I'm a consultant, coach, facilitator, strategist, daughter, sister, all of things. So all of the, I'm a graduate school dropout as well, as a very important identity to me. So my work as a coach and consultant at the Afrocentric Community, we just changed our mission statement. So this is super exciting. So what we do is help folks keep culture in mind as they build the infrastructure of their organization or business. So we want to teach people how to embrace, infuse, and incorporate culture into their everyday practice. And for me, I really want people to be, Black people specifically, to be excited about being different, to be proud of going against the grain, and to be really affirmed and encouraged and empowered to have an overtly cultural institution. And when I say institution, I mean business, organization. We've worked with people like fashion stylists to cultural producers, right? To birth workers, to teachers. I mean, and now I'm working with the theater. We work with a little bit of everybody. But in order for, I think the first step to Black love is to be proud of the word Black, right? And to be okay with what that means and what that comes with as a political identity. And I recognize that there are different, there are other ethnic communities or just communities across the world, right? There are different flags and different nations and things like that. But I do think it's important that we understand that as a political identity across the diaspora, what Black means and how we relate to the term Black on this binary of white people and Black people, right? And what that means and what we're advocating for ourselves. So that's what I want. That's how I'm hoping to help like amplify community is by amplifying culture. And getting people to be proud of who they are, wherever they are, and how they do what they do.
Hmm.
I don't know if that made any sense.
So one of the things I remember talking to you about early on is it's hard to talk about Blackness when a lot of people are ignorant of what that really means. But I do agree that like, being proud and in love with who you are as a Black person and your Black identity is really key and essential to doing collective community work. Because if you understand what Blackness means to you, then like whenever you get the anger or the vitriol or the criticism or the lack of support, like you can really emotionally connect with people to help them think through this. Because people, I think, are really confused. They don't really get a lot of guidance. And the guidance that they do get is oftentimes just through whatever they consume, like whatever media they consume or whatever social channel that they're involved in. I just, with community work, like getting people to participate in politics in America is so difficult because
yes.
Because there is just like a huge lack of care for the other person. And for me, what I learned just in doing the work is that like with this coronavirus, by the way, it's like also another really illuminating case study. Like mm-hmm. people will not want to take care of someone else by doing simple actions because of their own emotional feelings. One thing I heard that was like really alarming was like, I was listening to these interviews of people from like all over the country. This one woman in Georgia was just like, why get the vaccination when I don't even have access to simple healthcare in the first place? And, you know, they keep on asking me to go and get vaccinated. But once I get vaccinated, who's going to take care of me after that? Who's going to take care of my chronic illnesses? Who's going to take care of my child's asthma? And who's going to take care of this, like, bad pollution that's like in my neighborhood. So there's this, because of the lack of community care, this woman was in my head saying like, I don't care about myself because this country doesn't care about me. And in turn, I really wish that all the people who are asking me to be vaccinated would leave me alone. And it almost felt like she was hoping that she would pass on COVID to others, because she was just like, almost like she wanted to curse others with unhealth, because she had been given this situation where she could not access help. And I just feel like that's what I get a lot, or that's what I see a lot. It's like when I ask people to imagine a different world or participate in this activity, they actively want to fight against it because like they haven't been given love. And that's something that really has been heartbreaking for me. And I guess I wanted to know if you had any like insights into like these types of emotions that I come across sometimes when doing the work.
Yeah, I can relate to feeling helpless and hopeless in those situations, especially as, because we both do work that centers Black people, right, in the Black community. And it can be really sad when your own community doesn't understand the powerful impact of your work. But in that, there also has to be grace and this remembering that some people might get left behind, right? Which is a part of, for me, that's a part of Black love. You gotta identify with being Black in order to participate in Black love. Mm-hmm. And for the grace piece, it's just recognizing that our community has been fed so much misinformation, so much bad information, so many bad situations, consequences of things that we don't deserve, that I can't get upset that somebody doesn't see or realize the impact of what could be for them, right? That's a result of capitalism. I think one of the biggest harms is it prevents people from dreaming. Mm-hmm. Unshackled dreaming, right? Because capitalism's job is to feed you and consistently give you something to look forward to, something to do, and something to participate in that you don't have ownership of. Mm-hmm. So I always just have to remember that, okay, my people, Black people across the diaspora, okay, imperialism, colonialism, all of the things, we've all been fed. We're all living in limitations and boxes. And I might be one of the few who understands, okay, there is something else. I don't remember like the exact moment when I decided to be, when I decided to become a more conscious person, when I decided to really like live and breathe this this cultural practitioner lifestyle. I don't remember the moment, it just kind of happened, you know? But everybody doesn't have those moments. Because those moments, as we both know, it don't pay well.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't, it's you're not always actively welcomed into spaces. So I can't get mad if people choose something else, right? Their definition of love is loving themselves, and that's what loving themselves look like. Mm-hmm. Even if they can't make the relationship or don't understand how to make the connection between, okay, this version of loving yourself is actually impacting the greater whole, you know, in this way. So I can recognize or definitely empathize with feeling hopeless and helpless, but I also recognize some people will get left behind.
So that's a phrase you said a couple of times now, and I really want to like actually dive into that phrase. Like, not everyone's going to be able to come. Some people are going to get left behind. And I kind of want to know, like, what do you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. So when we're thinking about a revolution that requires Black love, a part of that is understanding similarities, right? There are going to be some of us who don't want to find similarities. I'm in conversation with those people all the time. Okay. There will be some people who actively do their best to try to distance themselves from Blackness. Mm. Right.
Yeah.
There will be people who will say, I don't want to wear the head wrap. Not even that I don't want to wear the head wrap, but you wearing a head wrap is hurting my ability to go into the corporate space.
I see.
Get the six figures, right? So right. Those people, they don't identify. They can't see, they're not willing to sit down and have a conversation with me and see where we're similar so that we can do this thing called Blackness together. Their job is to make sure they don't identify with Blackness in any form or fashion. Those are the people that just might get left behind. I don't want to talk in absolutes because I want to leave open the possibility for change or the possibility for growth, but I'm okay if they don't come. That's fine.
So like, I'm very much so getting like in the parable of the sower, in the parable of the talents, the main character always imagined this utopia somewhere in the cosmos where, like, you know, it's almost like this idea of like all the chosen ones are going to get on the mothership. And we're going to go to this place that was built just for us. And that's what I'm getting from that. And a part of me wants to know, like, because it almost is sounding like we're setting up two sides of a fight. They're the people who will actively fight to not participate in a healing process, to uphold systems that are predatory and do take advantage of Black and Indigenous people of color. And these people are of all ethnicities and all races. They just subscribe to this idea that ultimately supports the genocide of others. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who are looking to radically reimagine the world. And the thing between these two sides, the thing that I always keep thinking about is we've already lost so many people. Like, so many people have already been killed. And my revolution does not look like more fighting.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And so, like, is there, what does that mean when there's very clear two sides to this? Like, one side that just will not allow themselves to grow from this system that supports the genocide of others, and then others who are reimagining the world. Like, because we all have to find a way to grow. And if someone is actively upholding a predatory system, is there really a way for us to grow without it becoming or devolving into some sort of fight?
Yeah. Two things come up for me. In this utopia, there are problems, right? I'm not gonna make it seem like it is sunshine and roses and rainbows and glitter. No, it's not, it's definitely not. There are gonna be issues just like you have issues in your everyday life. I feel like what's unique about the people who decide to see the similarities first is they're willing to cultivate the tools to deal with those problems.
Mm.
Right? So they're willing to say, okay, we had a little issue, a little family tit for tat, right? Just your normal stuff that go on. In the quote unquote utopian version of that situation, how it would be handled is, okay, let's come together. Let's try to figure this thing out. Right? Is there an elder that we can bring in? Is there a mediator that we can bring in to help us figure out what the hell's going on? Right? I'm not saying we're going to have all the tools, but in the other in the other community, they're not willing to, I don't want a mediator. I don't want to figure this out with you. It's more of like a fuck you, fuck all of this, and I'm finna be out, right? So there's the first part of that. And I also don't think there has to be any fighting. I think that's what makes it so powerful, because a part of love is choosing yourself. That doesn't have to be nasty. It can just be as simple as, you know what, in this situation, I'm going to choose me and I'm going to choose righteousness. And righteousness doesn't always have to be a fight, right? It doesn't always have to be some, like, you know, warfare. It could be as simple as, I choose not to engage, right? Or I'm not going to be in this situation. So I'm just going to go do something else, right? And that's part of the power of love, right? If we're thinking to Dr. King, right? That's what made his movement so powerful, because that shit is hard.
Yeah.
That's hard. The easy thing to do is to, you know what I'm saying? We finna throw some balls and that's what everybody wants to do. But something that, as I think about being a mother and connected to like postpartum, and another book that I read, Love and Rage, which is where that liberation without our, cannot exist without our bodies quote comes from, is you have to cultivate a healthy relationship with anger, right? It's nothing wrong with being mad. That's fine. We don't tell people it's bad to be happy. Like, who says that? Like, don't nobody say that. So we shouldn't be saying that about anger either, right? Anger is fine. It's the same, thing as happiness. They're all on the same spectrum. It's about how you have a relationship with your anger, right? The anger can't use you. You got to use the anger.
Yeah. How are we going to use this anger to build systems of love? How is this anger going to be a catalyst for transformation, just like in the movie Waiting to Exhale?
Exactly.
What I'm getting from what your response is like that parable from the parable of Urugu, right? Urugu was part of two sets of twins. Mm-hmm. And then Urugu ate his female twin and became very angry and destructive. Whereas the other set of twins, they grew in love and creativity and created the world. However, Urugu still existed in this world, and he could not be destroyed because he was made of the same things as everyone in the world. So, like, this was just a force that existed. However, the more the other set of twins and their offsprings decided to focus on love and creativity and spirituality, they continued to create the world, whereas Urugu could only walk around the world angry and just kind of like always in the shadows. And I'm very much so getting that story from like the fact that there's always going to be like two groups. There's going to be the group that's centered in love and looking to grow and create the world. And then there's the group who is centered in destruction and does not want to grow in that, grow from that. There's nothing new under the sun. That's what I'm constantly reminded.
And there could very possibly be a group in the middle, right? Like, it doesn't, there is a gray. I don't know how to describe them yet, but I know that they exist. So I want to acknowledge that there might be some folks who are in between. But I think it's easiest to identify those who want to be rooted in love and those who actively perpetuate and defend and uplift oppressive systems.
Mm. So that leads me to another question, which is like, is it even possible to, like, you know, when they say decolonize education or get rid of capitalism? Is it like, if there's always going to be someone who's going to uphold these predatory systems, is it even possible to even get rid of these predatory systems?
That's a good question. Okay, so I feel like I'm going to make a comparison to being a business owner. So I have an LLC, you know, the Community of Rights is an LLC, which is, you know, a business structure in a capitalist system. There is a lot about, there's some rules and tax regulations that are just above me, child. I just got to follow them so I don't end up in jail, okay? Those are things that I personally, Jalen, all of the identities I mentioned before, I cannot change that. And I recognize that. But what I can do and what I try to do is create an experience and an internal culture and an internal system that does not uphold and uplift and perpetuate white supremacy, right? So there are levels. I think there are a lot of things that people feel like they cannot do. And I think a big part of capitalism also is making it hard for you to see the end result, right? I don't think anything is impossible. Okay. I don't think it's impossible to overturn capitalism. It's actually quite simple. Okay. But the system has made it so that we can't imagine doing that. It just takes a couple of steps. It do take a lot of people being on board. You know what I'm saying? It do take that. But is that impossible? No. It's not impossible. That is not impossible. It's just not. But we've been conditioned to think that it is so. So there are levels, you know, there are things that's like, ooh, child, me by myself, I can't change no tax rules, you know, but I can make an experience that gives my partners the ability to do this work in a sustainable way, in a way that empowers them, in a way that makes them feel like they are doing impactful work. And I do believe that that's happening from what people are telling me.
I think so too. I think leaving, when I left my undergraduate experience, what was that? I was like, it was like 2015. Mm-hmm. We were entering into like the Obama age. We didn't know the Trump age was right around the corner. Mm-hmm. And so I remember right after Trump got into office, one of the things I would hear a lot on podcasts is organizers and people saying like how woefully unprepared we were and how complacent we became in the idea that all these gains in justice that we have been experiencing throughout our lives was just, you know, what the world is. And how when things were becoming unjust, when the world was turning towards authoritarianism and fascist leaders, how we didn't have systems in place because we just assumed that the world would always be just and the tides would always be going in a just way. And since that moment, like I have experienced, and I've heard a lot of people speak on this in different formats of like how tired and how tiring it is to rebuild these systems that once were in place when Dr. King was alive. And I think the big dream for me is to have it so that it's designed that we are doing collective work and that the world isn't being held together by just one or two people. Mm-hmm. You know, like everyone by design is holding each other accountable. Everyone by design is creating systems that help increase health and wellness in the community so that not one person is going to be fatigued by the work because there's always a collective who's all doing the work and everyone gets a chance to rest. And I think that is the ultimate takeaway from all this. I think it's, you know, design is really about having intimate conversations so that we can understand what the problems are and then design into a system that you know, addresses those problems. So I we only have about maybe 10 minutes left.
No way.
I know, it goes so fast. I wanted to know, what are your like recaps or takeaways? Anything that maybe I haven't thought about in this conversation on love?
Oh man, I think it's been so good and so full. I'm following your lead. I think it's been really good.
Okay. At the end, this is the end. This is the last month that, or not the last month, but the last week of the month that I'm focusing on this topic. And from here, I'm moving into creative practices. Like we understand what love is. So now let's build creative practices. And so I guess that also speaks to this idea of designing processes. Some of the things that I've been struggling with is building teams, because just like
I said— Are you joining the reading group?
Huh?
Are you joining the reading group?
I'll join the reading group.
Okay, thank you.
I always like to have conversations. So yes, I'll definitely be there.
Okay, good.
What book are we reading?
Tell me. Emergent Strategy first.
Oh my God, I read that book. So yes.
Okay, yes, come.
I mean, I love how Adrienne Marie Brown starts off that book by talking about nature and how the fractal nature, how it builds itself. Like it just replicates like the same pattern over and over again until you have like everything that is within the system reflects the original pattern. And I think that also goes towards like systems, just like you, that's why you brought it up probably. Like system building has to reflect this original pattern that we put into our businesses, into our lives, into our communities. So that's where I'm at right now. Like I know that you've built a team. You are continuing to build a team.
I am.
I haven't really gotten there. I'm still like, I keep starting.
Yes, you have, Shatana. Well, we work together for your curriculum.
Well, yes, I have that. But I think what I feel still is like, for example, I have talks at the Schomburg that I'm preparing for. I have a workshop with Kindred Bookstore that I'm working on. I have all these things and like all these projects up in the air. And sometimes I'm just like, gosh, I just wish there was someone who could help me do this. Like, I feel like I'm still the machine. And if I'm not working, then nothing will get done, which is so true. Like, and I guess like that's the whole thing about creative processes is like, but I don't know. I guess I'm looking for advice. Like,
I think the thing that I have learned most with preparing a team is one, the education or the tools and the designing and the processes that has to happen eons before you even begin to do outreach to bring people onto your team. And so think of yourself as like a shepherd, right? And you're shepherding and guiding a flock of people. And I think if you transition, because I had to transition myself to this as well. It's like, when you hear that you're a shepherd leader, right? Or you're shepherding your flock, that's a completely different tone from like a boss. Mm. And like, it's so much more than giving people tasks, like sending emails. There's a culture and a way of being that starts with you that like flows into your team. So I think that's been one of the most important things that I've learned. I would say the other thing, nobody's gonna like this. Policies and procedures are key. I don't like, yes, we're doing cultural systems and cultural institutions, But we have always been a policies and procedures and protocol type of people. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's always been, this is the decorum. Okay. And so having those things written down before people come into your team is essential. Cause then what happens is, okay, you get to a moment, and this happens with everybody. This is a part of the process. Somebody ain't doing their work. You know what I'm saying? Somebody showing up late. Somebody not answering the phone. We work in a remote world. If you don't have the proper decorum, if you didn't give that person decorum, what are you going to hold them accountable to? Right. So starting to write those things down now, immediately, before they come on board. It can be five policy. You know, it's a sexual harassment, okay, missed tasks, company meeting policy. It just got to be a couple key ones, you know what I'm saying, that you can reference when that time comes, because it does happen naturally. You just got to be ready.
That goes back to love, like holding each other accountable.
Accountability.
Yeah.
Amen. Amen. So.
I thank you for this. This is giving me what I need to continue building. Because I always just need more voices. And I always say, like, I love you. I love your voice. I love your perspective.
Oh, thank you. I love you more. We need more of your work. So anything that I can do to help you keep going is what I want to do.
Well, then I'll definitely call you again for the podcast.
Okay. Sounds good. Sounds good.
Well, Jalen, have a good morning, and thank you for speaking to me.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Artivism Community Art is a production company that creates community-led media. Our products and services accommodate the lack of participation in creative fields among African Americans of all ages, by providing resources that teach the philosophy and design of the African diaspora. We help people diverse in age, race, and ethnicity create their own system of learning by providing resources and tools through our monthly subscription box. My name is Shatana Powell, founder of Artivism Community Art in Houston, Texas. According to a 2019 study by SMU Data Arts, less than 6% of African Americans are employed in creative fields in Houston, Texas. Less than 4% participate in cultural activities, despite the fact that African Americans make up 18% of the population. During our conferences between 2016 to 2020, Artivism Community Art found that the cultural practices of Black and Brown people are not well represented in the arts, culture, and education industry, resulting in a lack of participation and employment in creative fields among African Americans. Our products and services increase representation in the arts by employing Black and Indigenous creators to create and design culturally situated curriculum and art that centers the culture, lives, and history of Black and Indigenous populations. During our gatherings, both virtual and physical, we display the work and have interactive experiences, increasing opportunities for Black and Indigenous voices to be seen and amplified. To learn more, visit artivismcommunityart.com. Thank you.